So first, of course, I want to say something about Spencer, that when I hear that somebody, a new mathematician on the scene, to try to decide, you know, what I should think about it, and I'm very lazy, and I don't like to read proofs, and proofs are, can be long and technical, and often wrong, but if somebody has actually a beautiful idea that can be explained in a few lines, and my God, this is actually incredible, and I remember first, long ago, 71, 70, who knows, hearing about Bloch's formula that cycles modulo rational equivalence is Hn of Kn. And I thought I knew something about K theory, and it never had occurred to me that this had anything to do with rational equivalence of cycles. And I thought, my God, what a brilliant idea. This guy is, you know, really, really got it. And later on, I was trying to, I was very impressed, I was trying to make some examples of, you know, what complexes that would be arithmetic cohomology, what usually came to be called motivic cohomology. And, you know, I had conjectures that such things should exist, have certain properties, where to get examples. So first, I looked around and I found something called the Bloch complex, which turned out to be motivic cohomology in degree 2, or well, maybe up to torsion. But so I wanted to do something a little bit better. And I looked around and there was some Bloch's Duke book. There was a complex that actually did the right thing, not up to torsion. And then eventually, Bloch realized that, in fact, the higher child groups gave motivic cohomology for all degrees, not just for degree 2. So just Bloch, Bloch, and Bloch, competing with himself. So, so I was actually incredibly impressed. And there will be more Bloch later in the talk. I'll do that as we get to it. Okay. So the conjecture of Bertrand-Swift and Dyer. I'll start with that, or I'll start a little bit of that. Actually, it's misleading. First of all, of course, it's true. I'm not denying that it's, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it as a mathematical statement. But I just want to say, how do you think of the conjecture of Bertrand-Swift and Dyer? Let's go back. I think it was the first example of its type. You have the idea that the value, the order of the zero, say, of a zeta function or an L function should be given by the rank of some finally generated Abelian group, or maybe as the rank of a pair of finally generated, two finally generated Abelian groups of the same rank. In the case of Bertrand-Swift and Dyer, people didn't realize this so much maybe at first, but say an Abelian variety over a number field and the dual Abelian variety over the number field, two finally generated Abelian groups of the same rank. But you have this notion, finally generated Abelian group and the rank, and then the leading term of the Pauli series should be given by something connected with this finally generated abelian group, like the height pairing in the case of abelian varieties, and some finite groups, some rational numbers, some rational numbers, let's say orders of finite groups. And this is a beautiful and extremely influential, wonderful idea. But my point is that it should be taken more seriously. The idea should be taken more seriously. And the basic idea is that whenever you have an L function of a motive, a special value, so look, so M is some motive, and it doesn't, I'm not going to worry about what a motive is here. A motive is, let's say, an Abelian variety or a Tate motive, Z of R, or some combination, one motive, or anything else that you like that has an L function. I'm not going to be doing any mathematics really, so you're not going to have to worry about definitions. Suppose you have a motive M, and you look at a special value, which by twisting you can always assume is zero. So you're looking at the L of MS, the L function of the motive, at S equals zero, let's say. And you're looking at the leading term which we'll call L star of M zero. And so the idea should be that you have the sort of weak version of what I'm going to say is that there are some finally generated Abelian groups, as I said, pairs of finally generated Abelian groups, finite number of pairs, AI, BI. K okay? such that, well, first of all, the rank of, well, doesn't matter. Such that, one, well, we have, and there exist isomorphisms, AI tensors over Q, or over Z, C to BI tensor over Z, C, or FI. There exist these isomorphisms, and so in particular, the rank of AI is equal to the rank of BI. Okay. And such that, one, we have the order of the zero is equal to the sum plus or minus the rank of the AI, sum over I. Sometimes we take it with a plus sign, sometimes we take it with a minus sign. And the L star of M0 is equal up to a rational number, Q star, the determinant, the product over I, determinant of the Fi, 2 plus or minus 1. I guess the signs should probably correspond. Well, no, that's, in some sense, the signs should correspond, but that's a little bit too complicated. Let's just say that the plus or minus the rank of the AI here determines Fi plus or minus 1. Correspondence. Where is the 0 given by this? L star given by that. And I'll get to Birchwit and Dyer in a minute. If you think about it, you could wonder what the relation of Birchwit and Dyer is to these two things. Let me start with a case where this is sort of classic and well-known to get me easier into the subject. That if you take just the one M equals Z over a number field F, and so with L of M 0, just a zeta function, looking at the zeta function of F at 0, well, what's the order of the 0 of the zeta function at S equals 0? The order is given by R1 plus R2 minus 1. This is, and what is the leading term, zeta F star of 0? This is given by minus HR over W, where H is the class number, and R is the regulator, and W is the number of roots of unity. For F, of course. Okay. So what are our pairs of abelian groups here? Well, the pairs of abelian groups, only one pair, A1 and B1, and perversely, I will say A1 is the sum over the infinite places, the infinity of Z, divided by Z on the diagonal. And B1 is sum OF star, well, sum is what U with F, into Z. B1 is the Z dual of the unit group, sum of the unit group into Z. A1 is the sum of R1 plus R2 copies of Z divided by Z on the diagonal. These are both two abelian, these are two abelian groups of rank R1 plus R2 minus 1 by the Dirichlet unit theorem, this one. And the map, of course, is F1. Maps, in fact, it's defined over R, A1 tensor R, to B1 tensor R, it always extends to C, by 1 sub V goes to the homomorphism U goes to log absolute value U sub V, like that. Okay, this is your basic picture. It's well defined on this group by the product formula. Wonderful. Okay. And these things, of course, are proved by using the classical formula of Dirichlet and Dedekind zeta function as a simple pole at S equal 1, and they use the functional equation and the formula giving the residue of the which I'm going to get to in a minute. And so this is nothing very exciting here. Here we have just one pair of abelian groups you have the order given by the rank of either one, and you have the leading term given by a formula, which involves this F determinant of F1, of course, is the regulator, you should say. Determinant of F1 is, but that's the definition in some sense of the regulator. And these are Q star, these are finite. These are integers, H and W. So that's great. Okay. So let's move on. Everybody understands this. Let's move on to M is Z of 1. Z sub F of 1. So now we're looking at the zeta function. It's still the Riemann zeta function. 1. Okay, and let's record what we know here. We have a pole. Well, the 0 has order minus 1, right? Right, simple pole. 0 is minus 1. And the formula, which after a great many years I finally know, is that the residue, which is zeta F star of 1, is given by HR over W times the 2 to the R1 times the 2 pi to the R2 divided by the square root. The absolute value is a discriminant. Okay. So now what? What's the group? Well, we have a group of, we have zero of order, well, a pole of order 1, a zero of order minus 1. We, with first glance, think we should look for a group of rank 1 to account for this, but somehow a group of rank 1, there's a lot of stuff in here. A group of rank 1 is not going to account for that well. So we don't want that. Where life is more complicated. We have three pairs of groups that we have to deal with in this situation. We have, in this case, say A1 is going to be U of F. And there's a reason why I'm picking these actual choices. B1 is hum of this one into Z. Is the kernel of different Z, interesting, kernel of some map. So we have that, and the map F1 is just dual in some sense of this map. F1 of U is the map which takes 1 sub V to log absolute value of U sub V. So that's one, so that's one pair, A1 and B1. And what's the next pair? Well, we have A2. A2 is the kernel, and in very naive terms, A2 is the kernel of the map from the sum over the infinite places V, C, to sum over the infinite places V, C star, FV. To FV star. FV is R or C, depending on whether V is real or complex. It's the exponential. Of course, if V is real, there is no kernel. So you're looking at just the exponent, the imaginary primes here. A2 is the kernel of that. B2, we'll just take the sum over V of Z. Sum V complex. Complex primes. Okay, so this is a group of order R2. Mm-hmm. And this is a group of rank R2. This is also a group of rank R2. You have a kernel generated by 2 pi I Z, everybody knows. And what is F2 here? F2 is mapping this kernel to the maps A2, if you like, to the sum of C's for V, and it's just the identity, in some sense. We have 2 pi I goes to 2 pi I, if you like. Okay. And what's the determinant of this? This is... Remember, the bases are different. Here we have, this is a finite generated group, this is a finite generated group. Even though this is the density map, we're looking at the determinant of the density map with respect to two different bases. Yeah, I should have said over here, I took the determinant, what does it mean to take the determinant? That's very important. What does it mean to take the determinant of a map here of real vector space? It's not the same real vector space. If they were the same vector space, you know what determinant means. But here, the point is that you're given a natural class of bases, namely the bases that come from the finitely generated abelian groups, A1 and then B1, and they differ, I mean, it doesn't matter which basis you take, because determinant will differ by an element of GONZ, so plus or minus, the determinant of something GONZ plus or minus 1, we're only working up to Q star anyway, so it doesn't matter. So whenever I say the determinant, I mean the determinant with respect to bases obtained from these groups A1 and B1. Okay. So here, of course, the basis is these two pi i's, the two pi i goes to 2 pi i times 1, so the matrix is actually a bunch of 2 pi i's, and the determinant is 2 pi i to the R2. Okay. And what about the third group, third pair of groups? Well, the third pair of groups, we have A3, is OF, the ring of integers in F, and B3 is now the sum over all embeddings of F into the complex numbers, so there are R1 plus 2R2 of these now, of Z, okay. And so B2 tensor C is the sum of complex numbers R1 plus 2R2 times, and of course F3 of, let's say, X is just the collection sigma of X. So that's it. There. Mm-hmm. And what is the determinant of F3? Well, it's a standard result in algebraic number theory that determinant of this is the square root of the discriminant. Mm-hmm. Okay, but let me go a little bit further. Interesting. Notice that I have a square root of the discriminant over there, and somewhere in my formula I have something like a lot like that over here, but it's an absolute value of the discriminant. And can leave it as, it's a nice little exercise you can assign to beginning class in algebraic number theory, that this is, in fact, like minus, whatever way it goes, I guess I to the R2 times the square root of absolute value of the discriminant, like that. Okay. So in fact, if you, I can only realize it relatively recently. I don't know, so what does it matter? I'll work up the powers of I, throw that into the formula, into the conjecture or whatever. But in fact, it comes out just right. And that if you look at these three groups and you multiply determinants together, I mean, you have, of course, one gives you the regulator, one gives you up to a rational number, up to an integer, 2 to the R2, you get the, well, off the, you don't even need that. You get the 2 pi to the R2 times r to the R2. The r to the R2 is canceled down here. And so you get exactly this formula up to Q star. Okay. And I should say, of course, the order 0 is 1. Notice that the rank of A1 is R1 plus R2 minus 1. And the rank of A2 with R2. And the rank of A3 is R1 plus 2R2. And a simple computation, which even your students could do, says that minus 1 is R1 plus R2 minus 1 plus R2 minus R1 plus 2R2. So I have thought of making that the title of my talk, too. Minus 1 is theorem. Theorem, yes, right. Okay. Right. So we have that. And So, now let's look at Birchwit and Dyer, finally. See, we want, if you look at even the formula for, I'll be a little bit vague about Birchwit and Dyer, in fact, but I'll explain sort of what's happening. Because the intricacies of the period mapper, they're complicated, and I haven't quite worked out all of the actual details, but you'll see the picture. Birchwit and Dyer, even in the simplest case, even the case for which you win $1 million for elliptic curve over Q already, you have, the formula says that the L function is given by the orders of some finite groups times determinant of the height pairing times the real period. Okay? So according to this philosophy, you can't just shove the real period off into the closet. You have to deal with the real period. Everything has to fit together in this game. And the, well, I'll just say what the groups are. So in the Abelian variety, I'll give you some indication anyway. We have A1 is Abelian variety A, let's say, over number field F. A1, of course, is A of F. And A2 will be, B1 will be Hom of the dual Abelian variety A prime of F to Z. A prime is the dual Abelian variety. And A2 will be the Betti cohomology, some sense of A tensor over two with C plus, and the B2 is something like the tangent space to A. And A3 is going to be OF to the D. D is the dimension of A. I'll talk more about where these things come from and what they should actually mean in a minute. D is the dimension of A, and here, of course, we have the same thing as before, sum Z over sigma to the D now. Over here. So if I've done this right, this is supposed to have rank R, of course. And this has rank, these have rank N times D. D is the dimension of A. And N is the degree of F over Q. And this too, these have rank N D. So what I'm saying is that the, so to speak, correct form of Birchwit and Dyer is not that the order of the zero is equal to the rank, but the order of the zero is equal to the rank minus nd plus nd, which seriously is the rank. But it yes.
When you think of V of 1, could you just explain briefly why it is that in that case you need three groups, whereas in the case of V of 0 you need one?
I mean, let's see. I will later in the talk get to sort of a more complicated picture explaining what this means in terms of cohomology and so on. The actual answer, I mean, what I've said so far is also misleading, in that, in fact, the answer is going to be you only need two groups. That I did this way because it's easier to write down what the groups are. In fact, what happens is this involves a multiplicative Euler characteristic divided by an additive Euler characteristic. And one pair of groups comes from sort of the multiplicative side, the other pair of groups comes from the additive side. In the case of, in the case of motives of positive weight, in the case which is negative, we're looking at zeta functions of negative integers, then the additive side disappears. There's no tangent space to K theory. There's no tangent space to the motive of positive weight. So the additive part disappears. One of these groups goes away. On the other hand, there's no period map either. The top group, the multiplicative group, is in general an extension of a group having to do with the period map and an extension of the group that you know about. And in the, again, from the negative weight cases, that period map group isn't there. I mean, you see example, like if you look at the zeta function of positive integers, let's say, if you look at the zeta function, the Riemann zeta function at a positive even integer, you're going to get two groups, which cancel out to give an order of zero. And in the case of the Riemann zeta function at, Dedekind zeta function. You get three groups, and you'll get the groups are different depending on whether you have positive or odd or even integers. But I'll get to that when we talk about that. What's really going on? Okay, so let me in fact. Let me now get back to Bloch and talk about the Bloch-Kato conjecture and what that has to do with this picture and many other things. However, for most of the rest of the talk, I'm going to cheat. I say talk about the Bloch-Kato conjecture. The Bloch-Kato conjecture is a wonderful conjecture, which actually conjectures the through any motive. It gives you a formula for L star of M0 up to a rational motive. It gives you a formula L star of M0 up to a sign, I guess, in fact, the plus or minus one. It really predicts the rational term as well. And I haven't thought out well the rational terms for general motives, so I'm not going to worry about that part of the Bloch-Kato conjecture too much. I'm just going to worry about the Bloch-Kato conjecture up to Q star. Okay. I'm going to explain to you what it is, and then we'll explain to you what I think it should be in terms of this picture, and then I will make a connection between these two ways of looking at things. And I guess, in fact, there are a lot of people who contributed to this game, to this Bloch-Kato game, and a little bit, fantastic things, and it goes, it's Deline and Beyonson and Bloch-Kato and Tony Scholl and Fontaine and Karen Ryu. And maybe I left out somebody, but that's a reasonable list to conjure with. Okay, I think this thing I'm going to be talking about is probably closest to where Tony Scholl left it. So let's deal. And okay, so Bloch-Kato. So again, M is a motive over a number field, let's say. And we have six. So I'm going to ignore torsion. So this is mod torsion. So I'm going to work over Q. Instead of having finally generated a being. Beyonson's conjecture doesn't do it for all value, negative and positive values, I believe, right? I think there's a range restriction. That's what it is. So I think Tony extended it to... No, I'm wrong on that. Okay, so maybe I should just quote the Beyonson conjecture there. Yes. Okay. 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 So what is this conjecture? Given a motive M, we have six finally generated abelian groups. Six finally generated Q vector spaces right now, which is H naught F of M, H1 F of M. These are defined in terms of Fontaine's Fontaine's groups that I'm not going to worry about. H1 C of M, H2 C of M, and H1 B of M plus T sub M. These are six functionary Debye groups. They really, you only need the definitions of these two. HI, see them, is HOM H2. You can define it, if you like. It'd be H2 minus I F of N Q. N is the dual motive, or one positive way of talking about the dual motive, M star of one. Like that. Ah, okay. Let me read what I wrote again in case H0 sub F of M, H1 sub F of M, H1 sub C of M, H2 sub C of M, H1 B M plus T sub M, and H I C of M is HOM H2 minus I sub F of N Q, N is the dual motive. Okay. And there's a map, alpha sub M, mapping H1 B of M plus R, sub R is going to mean tensor with R, to T sub M R. But there's an operation of complex conjugation on this whole picture, and this is the invariance. And this map, this comes from the comparison isomorphism between Durham and Betty cohomology. That H1BM plus maps to H1BM, maps to H1 Durham, maps to, well, whatever. Yeah. This is the quotient. Okay. And so we have groups, we're also looking at the kernel of alpha M and the co-kernel of alpha M. And we have the six-term exact sequence, which goes like this. And we have 0 into H naught F of M, R into kernel. Let me start early. Give myself a maximum room. 0 into H naught F of M R into kernel F of M into H1 C of M R into H1 F of M R into co-kernel alpha M into H2C R into 0, and you wouldn't call this thing star, and you have, I'm not going to define anything here, this is not known to be, this is a conjecture, I mean, it's known to be true, say, for, probably for one motives, but in the category of arbitrary motives, I think it's completely unknown. If you have this conjecture, at least six-term exact sequence, you also, of course, have the more established sequence, kernel alpha M to H1, F of 2, H1, Betty, M plus, or T sub M R, to co-kernel of M 0. And the Bloch-Cathwell, as we say, Berenson conjecture here, says that the order of the 0 is the dimension of H1C of M minus the dimension of H2C of M. And the L of MS, S equals 0. Mm-hmm. And is that? And the leading term, L star of M0, since I'm only doing Balanchine now, not really blackouts, so up to Q star, is given by, in some sense, the determinant of star times maybe the determinant of this one, star star. If you have an exact sequence of vector spaces with bases, you can define the determinant of such a thing using exterior powers. And we have, since here, we have natural bases given to us for everything but these two. These are not integrally defined, but they fit into this sequence, so we take the basis, well, maybe I want to divide here. No, that's right. I mean, they come up in different places. This is the second place, this is the first place, so they actually cancel when you do this. You take a basis here, you take a basis here, you take the same basis here, those cancel out, it doesn't matter where you take, and everything else is integral, given to you. So this actually makes sense. As a real number. Okay, so this is a quick, very quick description of Balanchine conjecture as reformulating by Scholl and others. Okay, but what is this anyway? First of all, some people I gather think about this as some kind of exact sequence of continuous cohomology compact supports into cohomology, but all such sequences should be defined integrally. If you have a natural cohomology sequence, it should be defined over Z or over Q. You shouldn't need to go to R to define all of these maps in the sequence are defined over R. They're not integral. These are not integral maps. So, it looks funny. I know what should that be? And in terms of philosophy, the general picture I think you should have is that when you're thinking this way, you're sort of thinking of the Riemann-Roch theorem, curves even, let's say, Riemann-Roch theorem before anybody knew anything about sheaves. And the Riemann-Roch theorem said that L of D minus L of K minus D is equal to degree of D plus 1 minus G. Okay, but really it's combining two theorems. It's combining an Euler characteristic theorem for L of D, the sheaf L of D, H naught minus H1 is equal to something, and it's using theory duality, that H naught is, HI is H1 minus I of something else. Okay? It's really a mixture of two theorems, an Euler characteristic theorem and theory duality. And ideally that should be the picture for statements about L functions and motives. An L function and motives given by an Euler characteristic of the motive, the dual motive shouldn't have to come into it, just looking at the motive. And then there are duality theorems, of course, in cohomology, which correspond to stair duality in the Riemann-Roch case. So you see that's how you end up with formulas that involve the motive and the dual motive. Okay. So let me think about no, actually. Actually, what's going to happen? Let me jump ahead a bit. Okay. The idea is that the Euler characteristic is going to involve a cut product map from like an H1 to an H2. Okay. The Euler characteristic can involve a cut product map. This cut product map is the cut product with something that doesn't live over Z. Cut product, the element you're taking cut product with lives over R. So in order to have this cut product map, you have to go to R. But the cut product map is the only non-integral element of the whole picture. Everything non-integral is explained in terms of this cut product map. This is a pipe dream. This is an incredible guess. But and there's not terribly much evidence. But it just would be so beautiful if it were true, but I like it. So, okay. And I'll explain. Okay. So, yes. We're getting to that. You're anticipating. Okay. Yes. So now, Euler characteristic picture. And I'll tell you in a little while what we... Euler characteristic picture says that there should exist groups HI, I'll call it WC of M. So this is WC, W is Vieton, C is cohomology of compact support. And these should be finally generated abelian groups. And I could make a more general statement, but to stick to one, to MOSE over Q, let me, MOSE over F, let me just, I won't say the most general thing possible, but these groups, HIWCM, finally generated abelian groups, and also HIWC, let's say, additive of M, also finally generated abelian groups. Such that, and well, in this picture, H1WC of M, R, or C, let's say, isomorphic by H2WC MC. H1WC of F of M. See, isomorphic H2WC additive C. So these are the ones that are not these maps are not integrally defined, they're only rationally defined. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. For a curve over a finite field, these things are torsion. See, so what I'm doing now, when looking at Q, you wouldn't see these at all. I mean, the... Yeah, let me remind you the simplest possible case of this whole game is a point. If you look at a point over a finite field, the zeta function at 1 is given by q over q minus 1. And q is the Euler characteristic of the additive group, and the q minus 1 is the Euler characteristic of the multiplicative group. But and if you have a curve over a number field, you get a q is the 1 minus g, which is the additive Euler characteristic of the curve, the h1 of Ox and the h0 of Ox. The Q of the 1 minus G is going to correspond in the number field case to the discriminant, of course. That's a well-known analog. Q of the 1 minus G corresponds to the discriminant. Okay, and in this picture, we're going to have that the order of the 0 is the rank of H1WC, which is the multiplicative Euler characteristic thing, minus the rank of H1WC additive. And L star M0, let's call this F1, call this F2 here. L star M0 is just plus or minus up to Q star. Mike, I could do better, and I will, maybe in a little while, if I have time. L star M0 over isomorphic over Q star to the determinant of F1 times determinant of F2 inverse. Okay. So what's the relationship of this picture to the picture that I have over somewhere up there? What's the relation of these two pictures? Well, I mean, I tried to figure this out, and what I get is the following, and you'll see what that the theory is obviously not in its completed state. That would be a gross understatement. That we have some relationship. We have 0 into H naught Fm into H1 Betty M plus into H1 WCM. Well, let's do this over Q to be in the safe sign. Over Q. H1 WCM into H1 Fm into 0 and 0 into H1 CM into H2 WCM into H2 WC additive M into H2 CM into 0 with the over Q. And I'll write a dotted arrow here because you have an isomorphism here if the tensor with R. So let's see. You have a isomorphism there. Okay. Now, the point of this picture, as opposed to that picture, is that these maps are all integral, except for this one over here. This is an integral sequence. This is another integral sequence. Everything here is defined rationally. The irrational part, the transcendental part, comes from this Karpatic map over here. Okay. Notice that the alpha m in this picture is gotten by, we also have this thing. Oh yeah, I should say in this, isomorphic piece of them. So the alpha m is gotten by going here, going here, going here, taking the inverse. Well, we're taking the inverse of this map here. It's an isomorphism. So you can see where the comparison map comes from in this picture. And then it's an easy exercise to check that, first of all, if you believe that this sequence is exact and this sequence is exact, then the fixed term sequence is exact. Just diagram chasing. And that the formulas, this formula, which is basically in terms of Euler characteristics, is equivalent to the Balanchine formula. These are the same formulas. Okay, but this still leaves a lot to be desired. Namely, this sequence is quite comprehensible, the top sequence. This is, in fact, a sequence of Comaggio compact supports. It's clear what this ought to be. These things are real Comaggio over the ring of integers plus infinite primes. This is Comaggio compact support in infinity. This is Comaggio at infinity. This is a sequence of Comaggio compact support. But what's this? I don't know. How this fits into the picture, what that should be, I really don't have any idea. It works. It gives the relationship between the two theories. And I should say, in the case of one motives, I can. Let me say a little bit about that because it brings back Spencer to the picture. In the case of one motives, I can compute what all these groups are, and these things will make sense. Everything I say about the relationships between groups is a theorem. I mean, you can define everything just very concretely in terms of one motives, and you can prove everything. And of course, the L function statements are either theorems or they're theorems if you assume Birch-Witt and Dyer. And you're not going to prove Birch-Witt and Dyer this way. But I mean, all right. I shouldn't say I have actual proofs of them, but I mean, in terms of the technology is certainly there. It certainly could be proved up to Burst, Wind, and Dyer for one motives. Okay. And I should say that what is, for instance, if M is A, suppose M is an abelian variety. What is H1WC of M? Well, let me just give you a picture of what that is. Well, so of course M is an abelian variety of school A. Let A prime be the dual abelian variety. There's a there's a functor on one motives. This is a the picture I'm giving now is a variant of a picture of Tony Scholl's for all motives. This is sort of a concretization of it in the case of one motives. The functor on one motives, which takes M to M tilde, let's say. And if M is, for instance, a semi-abelian variety, if M is G, no X in the one no B finally generated abelian group in the one motive, M tilde is the one motive G of OF to G. And don't worry too much about what that means. G of OF to G. And also don't worry about the fact that it isn't actually a one motive because this has torsion, but that can be dealt with too. M tilde is G OF G. Let M prime be M tilde dual, take the dual one motive in the sense of Deligne. And basically, what happens if M is over Q, if A is over Q now, then we have that H1 WC of M is in fact H1 Betty of M tilde plus, which is also H1 Betty up to torsion. H1 Betty M double prime plus, like that. And this goes by alpha M double prime, it's a morphism, if we tensor with R, to T sub M double prime. R. And this is H2 WC M. And what is it? Let's look at what this M tilde D is. A very important construction, and of course it goes back to the sensor, because what this is, let's see, we have if M is A, we have M dual, oh shit, M dual tilde, if M is A, M dual is a prime, and M tilde dual is A prime of F into A prime, and M tilde dual prime, M tilde dual tilde, I'm getting this. Right. I mean, it is the this is a free module, a trivial free module, mapping to an abelian variety. The dual is such a one motive is an extension of the one motive by a torus. T into G into and the abelian variety here is the dual of this one, which is A again. Zero. And this is the semi-abelian variety constructed by Spencer. Spencer pointed out that from the point of view of getting good Tamagawa number form, is a natural thing to consider is not the abelian variety itself, but the sort of natural extension of the abelian variety by this torus, which the torus corresponding to the free abelian group, which given by the points of F, A prime of F, well, up to torsion. Okay, so Spencer again comes up in this picture over here. Okay, so finally, yeah. So this gives you some idea of what these H1s of WC look like. So in terms of what I said at the beginning, these H1W, if you work out what this is, I mean, this is all standard in terms of what Deline did, you can compute that the H1 of WC is an extension of H1, the rational points of A, by the Betti cohomology of A. So the again, the Birch-Witten-Dyer formula, the formula giving the order of the zero, is the rank of H1WC minus the rank of H1WC additive, and that turns out to be, of course, the rank of the Bean variety, but this is more reasonable interpretation of, I think, of what it, how you should think about it. Let's see. Let me get... And let me... Finally, just say one word about Euler characteristics in general. Well, let me say one word. What does this have to do with Weil-Weill cohomology, aside from the fact that I wrote down the word Weil-Weill? In the case that the motive is Z, or a twisted version of Z, I have a cohomology theory called Weil-Weill cohomology, and I can compute these groups in Weil-Weill cohomology. And these groups sort of come out, H1, H0, H1, H2, H3, come out to be what I said they are. And the exact sequence up there makes sense. I can interpret these things, actually compute these things as Weil-Weill cohomology groups. And we can give Euler characteristic formulas and Euler characteristic conjectures, even including the torsion, which I've sort of been neglecting for simplicity in the course of the talk. But the enormous problem is that in the Weil-Weill cohomology theory that I developed in this Grossmann-Dieck topology site, I don't know what the sheaf corresponding to the Bean variety should be. I don't know what the sheaf corresponding to GM should be. I have here descriptions of what the cohomology should be. See, what should the answer be when eventually when we're all done? What kind of cohomology should we compute? Well, here, I'm telling you, but. I don't even have a sheaf, so it's not even a question of I can't prove that the cohomology of the sheaf is what it should be. I can't define the sheaf. See, and I think this is, I'll close by saying, I think this is related to the question that André Weil asked, which is to interpret the full Edel class group as a Galois group rather than just the Edel class group modulo connected component. He gave this as one of the most important questions in number theory. And first of all, from today's perspective, you probably should say interpret the Weil group as a Galois group rather than the fully Edel class group as the abelianization of the Weil group. You probably want to actually think of it as trying to interpret the whole Weil group as a Galois group. And if trying to interpret the whole Weil group as a Galois group, that means there should be some field around. And the Weil group should act on this field. This field should be like, so GM, you know. And so I think of this as being a concretization in some way of Weil's question. I mean, can you actually define a sheaf GM in this topology? Which, in some sense, we use the Weil group. If you think of it on generic point, you have to think of it, where's the Weil group, what does the Weil group act on? Okay.
Can you repeat your last sentence?
Yeah, okay, the question is, can I repeat the last sentence and also say something about the additive picture, right? Yes. I haven't really discussed the Weil-Weill topology at all. The Weil-Weill topology is something that you get by sort of taking the cohomology of the Weil group, and I haven't even defined the Weil group, of course, but if you know what the Weil group is, fine. If not, don't worry about it. The cohomology of the Weil group at the generic point, In this topology, the vagary plays the role of the Galois group at the generic point. And then you try the Weierstrass topology sort of to spread out the vague group over the full ring of integers. And that's the point of it. But even at the generic point, it's not a problem with worrying about the integers rather than the rationals. Even at the generic point, I don't know how to define the sheaf GM or an abelian variety or anything like that for the vague group. Okay, and of course, equally well, I don't know how to define the additive group. If I could define the additive group, I probably could define the multiplicative group by taking the units. Which raises, by the way, an interesting question. You tend to think, if you're doing sort of Archelaus theory, or you're trying to, your first naive notion when you're looking at these things over the infinite, including the infinite primes, is that the natural notion of units at all primes, we take something with absolute value 1 at all primes, so then we have the root of unity. Okay. But that doesn't correspond to any, that's not the units of some ring. Right? I mean, if you actually want a relation to the multiplicative group and the additive group, that gets you into trouble. So it's not so, I don't know that it's not right, but I'm just saying that it's a problem. You worry about the fact that the roots of unity are not the units of anything. And if that's the multiplicative group, what's the additive group? So I actually lean to the idea that even in taking the infinite primes, the units are still the units that you think of somehow. But and as far as what the additive, I really don't know. I mean, there should be an additive picture. The point that something else I didn't really go into is that this all exists in the function field case. It exists in a beautiful, it's fairly complete, in a sense, in the function field case due to the work of Geiser. That now, and we have, there's a cohomology theory, Weierstrass cohomology, well, modified Weierstrass cohomology, let's say, in the function field case with the modification is due to Geiser. Which works for any variety, any quasi-projective variety, whether it's smooth or not, whether it's complete or projective or not. And you get these corresponding formulas are all theorems if you assume enough standard type conjectures, like resolution of singularities and rational equivalence is equal to numerical equivalence up to torsion and for varieties over finite fields. So in the finite field situation, this whole picture is right up to things everybody believes. You get these multiplicative order characteristics, you get additive order characteristics. I mean, you can sort of play this game. But of course, the number field cases is infinitely far from that picture. Yeah. Right.
What would you have in classical setting if you didn't have the
theory of Jeeves? Well, I mean, you obviously had the Riemann-Roch theorem long before you had Jeeves, right? And you knew what, in some sense, you had something like this. You knew what the groups were. You had certain groups. You could give a formula for the difference in their. You had some finite dimensional vector spaces, if you like. You could give a formula for the difference in the dimension of two finely generated vector spaces, and you could prove this formula, and you could do it without sheaves, and you got something. I can also define groups, and you could conjecture formulas and things. The thing is that the conjectures, if you suggest in terms of groups, it's not terribly exciting. I mean, I think it clarifies what you're doing to think of it in terms of order characteristic and things like that. But it's still the same picture, same conjectures that people have had before, the same theorems. The theorems in the case of Z and GM, and conjectures in the case of the B and varieties. But the idea is to somehow try to see what's really behind it. The basic problem, the absolute fundamental problem is to give a cohomological description of the zeta function or L function of a motive. It's to define a motive at all values, not just special values. What should that be? And why should there be Euler characteristic formulas in terms of cohomology of special values if there isn't a description of the whole L function in terms of cohomology? It makes no sense. there should be a description of the L function in terms of cohomology, and then that's the big problem.